Hello, everyone. Joshua Gilliland here, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me is Gnarly Ely. Let's do that again. Didn't sound right.
Although Gnarly has been a nickname in my past.
Gnarly. Hello, everyone. My name is Joshua Gilliland, one of the founding attorneys of the Legal Geeks. With me this evening is Gnarly Ely, and we're going to explore Ultra Q, the terror of sweet honey. Gnarly, how you doing tonight?
Doing great. So I still was unable to secure a Japanese beer during my quarantine. I do have a cherry blossom wine, so I think I am sufficiently in the spirit of the thing. And it's been a few days since DC started its serious lockdown, as opposed to the mild lockdown. But I've been kind of doing this self-isolation thing since the beginning of March, just to be safe. So it's same old here, doing just fine.
That's good. I have my easy cup sake, and it's since it's sake, still the same one because you only sip it, and
yeah.
That's how sake works. Just a couple sips, and you're good. And we're in the world where the CDC has said, like, hey, healthy people should wear masks too, and it's like, ooh, that's scary.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the couple weeks ago when we did the podcast involving shelter in place, we said that about a quarter of the country at the time was living under shelter in place orders. We are now at the point where a vast majority of Americans, almost all Americans, are living under some form of shelter in place or quarantine orders. So it's a crazy world, Josh.
Crazy world, and several of the governors have been downright heroic. I mean, I'm very proud of Governor Newsom, but the governor in Michigan, she rocks. I listened to a great interview with her on the Today Show, the Daily Show, since they're doing their shelter in place, social distancing spin. And she was very profound. And that woman is extremely bright and a great leader. So hats off to her for what she's doing. But there are the others who are slow to the draw.
Yeah.
You know, the problems in Florida with different counties having shelter in place and others not. That's just radically dangerous.
Yeah. It's a time for governors and mayors and other people in executive positions to either shine or not. So
yeah, Yeah, the anti-science group, they're not doing well right now. And was it the governor from Georgia? So, like, oh, I didn't know you could, you know, pass the...
I just learned you could have asymptomatic transmission. Yeah.
It's like, you're an idiot. You know, it's like he excels at suppressing voting rights. But when it comes to common sense and how germs work, he's an idiot. And the people of Georgia can do better. And they have a great alternative named Stacy for the future. If she's not Biden's VP nominee, but we'll see how that all goes.
We'll see how that cookie crumbles.
Yeah, that's my prediction. But I've been wrong many times in the past. But I'd go with her. I think that'd be a fun ticket. We're living in scary times, but there are a lot of heroic actions taking place that's actually pretty inspiring.
Including, hopefully, people who are listening who are doing their part by staying indoors. It's the least dramatic heroism that I've ever heard of, but it is heroism. So don't discount yourself if you're doing the right thing and nobody knows except maybe your cat. It's still important and it makes a big difference.
Grandpa, what did you do during the virus? Well, I watched a lot of TV, Johnny.
I binged watched Netflix for weeks. Wow, you saved so many lives. But it's true, I'm not being sarcastic.
Yeah, it's like, I watched Dark. Oh, that's good. All right, good stuff. It's been a great opportunity for us to explore now a little bit of Ultra Q, and there are a lot of other fun episodes that we can tackle. But the first one, The Terror of Sweet Honey, I watched this slack-jawed and thinking like, oh, this is just a pinata You really kick over the beehive of legal issues. It's just so much there.
Nice pun there, Josh. Nice pun.
Yes, it's what I do. It's what I do.
So for our listeners who maybe have not seen this episode, as the title implies, there are in fact beehives. So basically the short summary to set the stage is that a laboratory, the Isayama Agricultural Experiment Station, creates a special honey that comes from this special bee, a royal bee of some kind, that causes living things who consume it to grow to, you know, multiples of their size. I'm not sure exactly what the math is, but the bee looks to be at least like, you know, 20 times its ordinary size.
More than 20, like 500. Like the
yeah, bee- okay, so we'll go with at least 100 times their size.
Yeah.
And, you know, antics ensue.
Yeah, so we have, it opens with, you know, the narrator, and that's consistent. For those who haven't seen Ultra Q, it's a mix of Outer Limits and Twilight Zone.
I was gonna say, definitely some Twilight Zone.
And X-Files, maybe a little Millennium, all rolled into one, and it's glorious. And some of the episodes are really great. Some are weird. we'll deal with those in time. But this one was just fun, and especially from the legal perspective. So we get the station, and we see like a greenhouse, and it's a storm, and we see a guy in a lab coat go pick up a hammer. And then he goes to the greenhouse and he unlocks the door and he goes in and a ruckus is heard. Mm-hmm. We have a guy who's referred to as Grandpa somebody who sees the individual kind of flaying around, like doing like the scared Kermit the Frog running around with the arms up type of thing. And he's... you wonder if he's wigging out, but it probably makes more sense that he just upset the bees.
Right.
Who are, and but we don't see him with bee stings. But so maybe he got out okay. And after that, we have our heroes who are, you know, doing their flying lessons in what looks like a Cessna. And
yeah.
There is a beautiful model work and live action of a train. And part of the train tracks go up because there's something underground that disrupts the train tracks, and there's a big train derailment. And the guys in the plane don't make a radio call. They decide to fly back and report it. So we don't know who lived and died when this train with cargo, so there's lumber.
Yeah.
It wasn't like...
I think it's safe to assume that the engineer at the front of the train was at minimum injured.
Yeah, he was either highly maimed or dead. Like there, and I don't know. I mean, there had to be other people on board manning it.
Right. I think even in the United States currently, minimum train crew is at least two people.
Yeah, just sending out one seems to be asking for trouble.
Yeah, and this was also a long time ago before we had any automation, so they definitely had more than one person on that train.
Yeah, it doesn't look like anyone's shoveling coal, but I'm pretty sure a boiler exploded at some point.
Yeah,
it's just big train, boiler, crash.
I assume this show is intended to be accessible to children. So we do not see anyone get maimed, but I think it is safe for the adults in the room to assume.
Yeah, you watch it and it goes like, oh, how would you survive? Do you just like hunker down and hope for the best in the locomotive, thinking that that's going to be like a giant battering ram and hopefully it doesn't blow up with you in it? Because all the crap flying behind you, like logs.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just, there's stuff that can crush people very easily. So,
injury has occurred. That is what we as the legal geeks are fairly confident of.
Yeah. There is property damage at this point in time. So we then pivot to, you know, what looks like, you know, kind of the two lovers on a walk and the man.
Yes.
Because he's concerned about a presentation he has to give and he's engaged to this woman. And the science dude, his name is Kimura.
Kimura, yep.
And the love interest is Akiko. And she speaks, she does more than glare, but she does have some glaring because we do have bad science man, Itami. Mm-hmm. And he's, you know, he's just a jerk. You know, like that's just legal definition.
He is envy incarnate. He is jealous of everything that Kimura is and has, it appears.
When you talk to somebody with your back towards them while smoking, that speaks volumes about the character.
Yeah, that's you're at cartoon villain level, so yes. He is definitely very clearly a bad guy.
Yeah, and in order to understand all the legal analysis, we do have to explain what happened. Because with the Scooby-Doo moment where our heroes explain it was Itami who went into the greenhouse, smashed the glass. We don't know if he let the mole in or brought the mole with him, but he brought a mole with him who feasted upon the honey. And the mole grew really big and then started doing lots of property damage. And so that raises the issue, all kinds of weird legal issues. Because his motivations for doing this, Nora, do you want to explain why he did what he did?
Yes. So there's a dramatic scene in which the Itami and Kimura are in a tunnel dug out by this enormous mole, and Kimura asks Itami, why have you done this? And Itami responds tersely, oh, I was jealous that you were accepted by the Academy of Sciences. I've always been jealous, and nothing makes me more upset than when someone is better than me at something. And of course, you know, understandably, Kimura is not, it doesn't really believe that would be the reason to commit these heinous acts, what with wanton disregard for the safety of others and their property. So he says, no, there must be something else. Why did you do this? And if I remember right, Itami refuses to admit what we all know as the viewers know to be true, which is that he is jealous of Kimura's engagement to Aiko. And this is a little interesting just because, you know, it's safe to assume that at some point over the course of this episode, the mole has caused someone to die, whether it be the train engineer or whether it be someone in the village at the end when there are seismic disruptions that cause it to sink underground. probably somebody died. Definitely there was an injury. And motive starts to matter when you get into assault and definitely homicide. And the key distinction, for example, of downgrading something to secondary murder instead of first degree murder, one of the big distinctions is, or one of the ways to get there is, I did it in a fit of passion. It may sound a little bit weird, but I think when you think it through, it makes sense that there are certain things that we as a society believe that will incense an otherwise good moral person. And that if you have insufficient time to think about what you're doing, what your actions and the consequences, you can be overwhelmed by those emotions and do something that is immoral. So it matters as to whether he was professionally jealous or whether he was romantically jealous, because I think we all would agree, and I think any jury in the world would agree, that professional jealousy does not sufficiently inflame the emotions of ordinarily good people to cause them to act with such wanton disregard for the lives and safety of others.
Yeah, there's a big difference between walking in on your spouse with another lover.
Right, which is the stereotypical example.
Opposed to, how dare you get that patent before me?
Yes, yes. And there is a difference, and we perceive there to be a difference in culpability. I think there is a big difference in culpability. The other one is, of course, also the amount of time that lapses between the thing that was supposed to have inflamed your emotions and the act. And in this, this almost certainly does not excuse Atami's conduct here. Nothing justifies it, by the way. A justification would be like an affirmative defense, like self-defense. But it might excuse it so that he gets a lower penalty. But there's also a long time between when Kimura and Aiko got engaged, and this clearly well thought out premeditated act, right, which was breaking into or sneaking into the greenhouse, feeding the mole the honey, trying to frame Kimura as the negligent scientist who didn't observe safety regulations. You're not gonna get a crime of passion excuse if it's premeditated.
No, you're not. The lines that he has in front of multiple witnesses. So it's not just, our hero. It's, I was jealous. I hated losing to others. I can't bear to live being surpassed by an academic rival like you.
Which are clearly the words of an unfortunate, tragic hero, right?
Yeah, this is Dr. Doom level, like, supervillain type behavior. You throw in the girl as, I mean, almost like an afterthought, because it's like, yes, you were also getting married. Yeah. And like he has this like weird shaming exchange, because our hero is like super sad about what's going on. A village is destroyed. Homes are ruined, farms are knocked out, livestock's eaten, farmers are super angry. And
they're so angry they're convinced that the agricultural lab was trying to ruin them.
and we have this exchange, where Tommy says, maybe you let your guard down, and then like glared over at his fiance.
It's just my God. Yeah, no. Tommy is definitely the bad guy, and I wish his defense lawyer luck, but I don't think you're gonna get any kind of reduction in the severity of these crimes.
No, unless this professional jealousy is common in Japan and jurors would find that sympathetic, but I don't think so. I think most people go like, what? You fed this special honey to a mole that grew? What the hell, dude? What? Because you were jealous?
Yeah. And even with romantic jealousy, slightly more understandable than professional jealousy, probably not going to get to the level you need to create an excuse. And again, there's the problem that you stewed on this. You sat there and you stewed on this and thought about what you were doing and planned it. And that's where we don't allow for those kinds of excuses to make a difference in your penalties or the severity of the crime, is you had lots of time to consider the ramifications of your actions and decided, I'm going to do this anyway.
Yeah, lying awake at night, he's got the girl, he's got the science award, they want him and they don't want me. Oh, I can't take this. Dude, get therapy. Like, what the...
Yeah.
That's your plan? That's how you're going to solve the problem, that I'm not going to work harder. I want to ruin another person's life and see if I can knock out a fiance.
And with collateral damage being the entire town.
Yes. and the poor train. So
yeah.
So let's break down some of the damage caused by the mole and then figure out
who's liable.
Yeah. So first up, is the agricultural experiment station responsible for Atami's intentional actions? And that raises the specter of respondent superior. And
right, so Atami is another employee of this lab, if we hadn't made that clear before.
Yes. Do you want to walk us through the respondent superior rules and how that can play out?
Sure. So The short version of this, although I will read out the definition just because I think it, you know, one of the most important things for lawyers is to know what the definitions are. But the basic principle is that employers can be liable for negligent and intentional torts committed by an employee, if the employee committed them within the scope of their employment. And that's the critical phrase. So the full quote here is, it is well established that the traditional vicarious liability rules ordinarily make principals or employers vicariously liable for the acts of their agents or employees in the scope of their authority or employment. And that's Burlington Industries, Inc. versus Ellerth. And so here's the question. Is what Itami was doing within the scope of his employment?
No. I mean, like,
let's try to think of an example of something that would be clearly within the scope of an employee's employment, right? Just as the counterexample.
So let's just say that he is supervising the experiment the night of the storm. So that's why he's at the lab, and his responsibility is to observe all the experiments that they have going to make sure that nothing happens during the storm. Thus, and like while there, he's listening to rock music and
fails to notice that his pet mole has escaped.
Yeah, you know, his lifelong companion, a rodent,
his emotional support mole.
Because I go to dark places, so the mole goes with me. That could be within the scope of his employment if they allowed the emotional support mole to be in the lab.
An intentional tort that might be within scope of employment, I think the stereotypical example is like a delivery driver who crashes the truck into another car because he has road rage. It's an intentional tort. And clearly most employees' employment do not specify you're supposed to intentionally injure people, but he was the employee's job is to drive the truck. So I think there's a serious argument there that even though it's an intentional tort, it was within the scope of his employment. If he was off his delivery route, though, we could get into a million hypotheticals here. It's usually a little bit trickier to fit an intentional tort into the scope of employment, but it's possible. In this case, with Itami, I have a very hard time seeing it because, number one, it looks pretty clear that he's outside his normal working hours. He's not supposed to be in the greenhouse at this time. It's not, as you suggested, his duty to watch over the greenhouse during the storm. And it's definitely not within his scope of employment, I think, to bring in other animals to eat the honey. I can actually imagine a hypothetical in which that was one of the experiments, that they were going to feed it to animals other than bees. Maybe that was there.
Possibly. It's extreme of, but I don't think that this is within the scope of his employment at all.
Yeah. I again wish his defense lawyer luck. I think there is a slightly more colorable argument here than with, you know, crime of passion excuse. But I agree. I think it's going to be very difficult to argue that Tommy's intentional tort was within the scope of his employment.
Yeah, just not going to happen. It just, yeah. So now, prior to the knowledge about Tommy's actions, the plant manager and our hero go check out the village that had a mole attack. And the farmers are upset. And rightfully so. It's like homes are crushed, farmlands ruined, their cattle's been eaten. They are not happy. And the plant manager says, as the plant manager, I am responsible. And as a lawyer, I would have tackled him and muzzled him to go, shut up, shut up, shut up. No, no, no. Whether it's the blow dart to knock him out or or me playing football player. Yeah, you don't want, you know, a manager basically admitting liability for a giant mole terrorizing the countryside.
Yeah. With almost certainly more property damage than that lab is worth.
Yeah, and what's funny is, I don't know if it was just his command presence, but, you know, I am responsible. The farmer's like, oh, okay. Like, they just backed out at that point. Okay, we see you're sorry. It's just, it's like, well, that's weird. I don't know if it's a cultural thing of...
Yeah, I don't want to speculate too much, not being, you know, that all that familiar with Japanese culture. But I do know that it's a thing that when things go wrong with Japanese corporations, there are usually high-level executives that line up to take responsibility, as opposed to my perception in the United States is high-level executives line up to point fingers at lower-level managers.
Or they do depositions with lots of doublespeak that don't amount to anything.
Yeah. So it's possible that that was a cultural thing. I agree with you, though, that if we're operating under U.S. law, blow dart to the neck right there.
Oh, did it? Drag him away.
Yeah. Assuming that we don't know, assuming they never knew that Itami committed this intentional tort, and we we're in the world in which we believe it was Kimura's negligence in securing the lab or whatnot against mole invasion that led to this, is the supervisor or is the lab now liable under respondeat superior?
I don't think so. And here's my thought process on it. They took the steps to prevent intrusion from animals such as moles. They, you know, there's concrete underneath, mm-hmm. so nothing can burrow inside. The dirt only goes down like 6 inches. So it's kind of like a topside bunker. And the windows were double paned. So you would really need to commit an intentional act in order to break the glass, because under normal conditions, the glass wouldn't just break. You would, and this is beyond a normal standard of care, because they knew that, hey, we're playing God with this honey. So they did take reasonable precautions to make sure that the bee wouldn't get out and change the ecosystem.
I am so ready to push back on this. So.
Bring it, girl.
There are two topics that I want to bring this up under. The first is a discussion of superseding causes. It highlights a principle in tort law, which is, it's there just within simple negligence, not just when you allege that there's an intervening cause that supersedes you, but which is foreseeability. So I'm going to talk about that. The other thing that I want to bookmark that we should get to is also strict liability for ultra-hazardous activities, but we'll get to that in a second. So when it comes to, you know, did they exercise reasonable care, it matters a lot as to what are the foreseeable things that could happen to this greenhouse. I agree with you that they did clearly secure it against moles. I think, though, that there's a serious argument that it was not sufficiently secured against, you know, larger animals. There are larger animals in Japan. I'm not sure if there are honey-eating bears, of course, but there are deer. I don't know. And it's honey. Honey is attractive to a large number of animals. Bears. They do have bears? Yeah. My boyfriend who grew up in Japan is telling me they do have bears. It's possible that they did not sufficiently secure this greenhouse against very foreseeable just animal life threats, not even getting to Itami at this point as a superseding cause. The second part of that is also, you know, was Itami, you know, sneaking into the lab to steal honey or feed it to something, was that foreseeable? I think it actually might have been. This is an extremely valuable, extremely dangerous substance, but... I have to cut that conversation off a little short, because in most states have made it such that all intentional torts count as superseding causes, whether or not it was foreseeable. But so to clarify also, the reason why I'm so caught up on foreseeability is because not all intervening causes will relieve a defendant of civil liability. If a intervening cause was foreseeable, then it was still negligent for the potential tortfeasor to have not secured guarded against that possibility. But I do see the logic in precluding intentional torts from that kind of a liability. So, just looking at the foreseeability, you know, I think there's some colorable arguments that they still did not sufficiently secure this against natural threats. Because it was a mole, though, and because the other intervening cause was an intentional tort, I agree with you. Now I want to talk about strict liability. So, strict liability is a doctrine, or strict liability for ultra-hazardous activities is a doctrine that applies to injuries that result from handling of ultra-hazardous substances, such as radioactive material, or activities that are considered inherently dangerous, like blowing something up with dynamite. And we, you know, because these things are so inherently dangerous, the law generally does not care for a nuanced analysis about whether or not this person took sufficient care. The law wants to incentivize the highest standard of care when it comes to these activities, so you just get held liable if injuries result from your activity, if it's ultra-hazardous. Now, is jelly and honey an ultra-hazardous material, Josh?
That remains to be seen. So, you know, so they wanted to, they don't really fully explain why they're developing this. Like if they're trying to deal with food shortages, is this, well, we can, so we'll figure out a good use for it later. I mean, like there could be that at play. And we do have a scene where, you know, our heroes, the investigative team goes in, and they hold up, the little jar of honey as the plant manager is explaining what it is. And one of the characters says, like, oh, I'm going to, like, take a taste. And, like, the plant manager immediately
literally
stops.
Pours some out on his hand and is about to lick his hand. This is clearly pre-coronavirus.
And the scientist stops and go, like, dude, what's wrong with you? Like, this is a science lab. Why you're just going to put that in your mouth? You suck on doorknobs? Like, what's wrong with you? And because if he had eaten it, you know, it could have affected him negatively because they dilute it hundreds of times before putting it to use.
Mm-hmm.
So it's, you know, highly concentrated form. Now, that bottle did not contain a warning label. And
no discernible warning label as far as I could see. Nope.
And so that raises all kinds of issues. So let's talk about what the warning label issue is. First off, is there a duty to warn about eating the honey Jillian? And under U.S. law, a special liability of seller of a product for physical harm to user or consumer, one who sells any product in a defective condition, unreasonably dangerous to the user or community or to his property, is subject to liability for physical harm, thereby caused to the ultimate user or consumer or to his property. And it's like, well, okay. Now there's some subsections for this because like this wasn't yet a seller. Like this was the lab. So it wasn't like in the production side. So it's still in development. So that is something that's different. But you know, the California rule on this is a manufacturer is strictly liable in tort when an article he places on the market proves to have a defect that causes injury to a human being. So it's not on the market yet. This is just a moron deciding I'm going to have some of the honey.
Yeah.
It's like, oh wow, it made a giant bee. Let me put some on my hand. So again, the scientist going like that look of like shock.
Also, wasn't it supposed to be, like, I don't know, government agent inspecting it or someone from the Science Academy coming, like,
yeah.
Why do you not have some experience in practice or protocols? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, just the look of, like, the double take of what?
Also, there is a little bit of cavalier attitude among the scientists, though. I recall shortly thereafter, they're all laughing amongst themselves and saying, oh, ha, 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 he almost became a giant.
Well, you know, this is far enough into the season that stuff like this has been happening, so they're probably used to it.
Right, right.
uh, this also pivots to the issue of, is it adequately labeled? And any drug or device is misbranded unless its labeling bears all the following information: adequate directions for use, such adequate warnings against use in pathological conditions or by children where its use may be dangerous to health, adequate warning about unsafe dosage or methods of or duration of administration or application. So while this is magical honey, it's not like meant for table consumption.
Yeah.
It's more like a drug that they want to be able to use for either pharmaceutical or agricultural purposes here.
Yeah, I would assume agricultural because it's an agricultural lab, but I agree it's not made clear what they're using it for or what they intend to use it for. But yes, I agree that it is reasonable to construe this as a drug, especially because they do obviously have certain protocols within the lab for things like dosage, as you emphasize, so they dilute it hundreds of times, and application. So, you know, don't smear it on your hand. It's not the preferred method of application.
Yeah, and again, this is the thing in old monster movies from the 50s or 60s, like people encounter some toxic substance, they go up and touch it. It's like, what's wrong with you? It's like,
literally the toddler reaction. What is this thing? I don't know what it is. I should put it in my mouth.
I'm going to take off my shirt and roll around on it. It's like, this is going to end horribly for you. You're going to go out with lymphoma because of your idiocy. Don't do that.
Health and safety codes are there for a reason. But I think that this does raise serious questions about, mostly the labeling. I agree with you that in this case, because they're clearly not selling it, I don't know that they have a particular duty to warn. I do think, though, that the California Health and Safety Code as written does not include that it's limited only to products that are being sold. It seems reasonable that they should be required to label that thing, whether or not they're going to sell it.
Yeah, it doesn't have to be, couldn't cause you to grow to a giant size. It could simply be not for human consumption.
Exactly, yeah. Or, toxic chemical symbol, that would have done it. XXX even might have done it.
Don't put this in your mouth.
Yeah.
But it's honey. No, don't do that. But I want to. No, bad. So, that's all bad. That's all bad. So we have an escalation in property damage, and let's talk about some of the property damage that happens here.
Should we talk about the train first?
Yeah, let's start with the train because that's the first incident.
And it happens to be slightly topical in the state of California where Josh lives right now.
Yeah, there's I feel concerned for the DAs in Los Angeles who go like, wow, we're actually going to get to prosecute someone for train wrecking. That used to be a thing in the 19th century. There are a handful of 20th century cases, but and there's also the federal side of this as well, because he was targeting a U.S. naval ship.
And if anybody watches NCIS, this is definitely going to be a jurisdiction fight.
Both can prosecute. Both can have them. And so what happened is, well, we don't know all the facts. We just know that somebody who believes in conspiracies thought the federal government was trying to do a takeover of the state of California by sending one of the hospital ships here. So he decided to drive a train into the hospital ship. And you might think like, wow, does the train tracks go all the way up to the ship? And the answer is no. No, they do not. So he didn't get far.
By the way, we are treating this with a little bit of levity because nobody was hurt, as far as we can tell, except for the guy who actually did it suffered some minor injuries, I believe.
And the train seen better days. So.
Yes. But nobody died. Nobody was seriously hurt. This is now that we can laugh at this guy's expense.
So I can say crazy because, one, the level of tinfoil hat conspiracy people out there is terrifying. but you know, that just believes. So the ship came down to help the people of Southern California who are suffering from a pandemic, so people don't die. That's why the Navy's there. And this dude thinks they're doing a takeover of California. So do whatever psychoanalysis you want to on that person. But he tried driving a train into the USS Mercy. And it's just like, dude, he didn't make it. He didn't get there.
No. So there are concrete barriers at the end of the tracks that are supposed to stop runaway trains. And, you know, obviously this was not a quote-unquote runaway train. This was intentional, but yes. And there is not track going past that all the way into the harbor. So, yeah, there's a friction problem here, too.
Again, as we discussed prior to recording, but this is a wonderful math problem of how fast would the train have to go crash through the concrete and yet maintain a velocity to not just cover the distance without railroad tracks, but to hit the ship with enough force to damage it.
Right. To hit the ship with enough force that they don't think somebody knocked on the port hatch.
Bob, what was that? I don't know, Jerry. Check it out, will ya?
Regardless of why this happened, it happened. The train wreck that occurs in this episode, somewhat topical. Yeah. But so it is its own separate crime, is it not, Josh?
Yes, it is. So in California, the rule on train wrecking says every person who unlawfully throws a switch, removes a rail, or places any obstruction on any railroad with the intention of derailing any passenger, freight, or other train, car, or engine, or who unlawfully places any dynamite or other explosive material or any other obstruction upon or near the track of any railroad with the intention of blowing up or derailing any such train, car, or engine, or who unlawfully sets fire to any railroad bridge or a trestle over which any such train, car, or engine must pass with the intention of wrecking such train, car, or engine, is guilty of a felony and shall be punished by imprisonment in the state prison for life without possibility of parole. There were other states that actually had death penalty offenses for this. This used to be a problem in the 19th century, and we didn't tolerate it. And especially in like the territory of New Mexico, the cowboy states.
I was going to say, this sounds like it's straight out of a Western movie. They're trying to, rob the train or something, so they're derailing it.
Yeah, and laws aren't written proactively. So bad things occurred that required people to write laws with teeth. There were people who were really upset who went, not anymore. No. You derail the train, you get hung. There were some other cases that I saw in other posts about train wrecking, whether it was Back to the Future 3 or Solo,
that getting
to train wrecking. And
that was many forms of train wrecking according to this definition.
You blow up a train, you're getting the death penalty in some states. So they play to win. It's a deterrent for a reason. So I didn't see the federal equivalent of this or how they're going to tackle this because of the target and the intent.
Right.
And there could be some interesting insanity defense options here that come into play. And it does remind me just a little bit of the Gitarew case. And he was the man who assassinated President Garfield. Mm. And there's a magnificent book called Destiny of the Republic. Because Garfield was only in office 3 months before he got shot. And probably one of the smartest presidents we ever had. And the guy who shot him was nuts. But he understood right from wrong.
Right.
And so they, after a lengthy trial, like the jury found him guilty and gave him the death sentence in like half an hour or something, some really short amount of time for a jury to deliberate with, like, nope, nope. We know he's crazy, but he knows right from wrong. So just because he was a delusional mind doesn't absolve him of guilt because he still understood the wrongfulness of his actions.
Right. So for our listeners, the insanity defense is not that you are any kind of insane. There are specific types or specific consequences of your insanity that have to occur in order to excuse you for committing a crime or in order to, essentially prevent you from having the full punishment. One of them is, like you were saying, you have to not be able to distinguish between right and wrong. And correct me if I'm wrong, Josh, because I will, of course, mention that I am not an expert in criminal law. I do not practice criminal law. But I believe one of the other ones that can excuse you is if you were delusional such that you did not have knowledge of what it was you were doing. So that would be like I was schizophrenic and I thought that what I was holding was a television remote. And in fact, it turned out to be a gun.
Yes. Yes, that would be one of them. And there are many flavors of the insanity defense. And it's, that's a law review article right there. And
right.
All the different, there are multiple forms of it. And on our Patreon, I did break down a bunch of them and talking about some of the-
Oh, nice.
Yeah, on the ways of defending Harbinger in the Arrow crossover and in the comics. So that's up there. I don't know what's going to happen in this case. And anyone who says so is clearly either a fortune teller or lying.
Not a lot of facts out there. So there's going to be a lot of speculation.
Yeah. So I don't envy the DA, probably the public defender. Because I don't see this dude getting his own attorney. And, the judge, because this could be a real clown rodeo quickly. And
to bring this back to Itami, is Itami going to go to prison for life without the possibility of parole?
This is where, because he doesn't personally do it, it's the mole that he fed the honey to, which then raises the issue: did he have the mole with him and was like force feeding the mole honey, or did? Did he merely break the glass so a mole would get in, or did he not know what would get in? So there's some intent questions that come into play.
Yeah, and the intent in this statute also specifies that you have to have intended to derail or intended to wreck. And it seems to me that as bad as Itami is, the malice or the intent that he holds towards the various victims of his megamole is at best recklessness or indifference. It does not appear that he intends to hurt them. He intends to hurt Kimura.
Yeah, it's like, I want to discredit you and say like, ha-ha, there's a giant mole eating cows now. Ha-ha. As opposed to, yes, we're going to go derail trains and do lots
of... Yeah. And so, I think it's appropriate that there is a specific intent in this statute because it comes with it, the shall be punished by imprisonment for life without possibility of parole. When you have a very severe punishment like that, it's appropriate that there is a high level of intent required.
Yeah, but then you throw in a giant mole. And, you know, the reply might be, what did you expect to have?
Yeah, well... So I think that there are certainly crimes, and we're going to get to one of them in a second because it's a little fun to discuss, but there are certainly crimes that Itami can be prosecuted for. And we talked about them. You know, there are probably people who died. There are probably people who were injured and assaulted and battered. And those kinds of things, you can have lower levels of intent. And one of them, which I always like to mention, is just because it's such a fun phrase, depraved heart murder. You don't necessarily need to, and I think depraved heart murder varies in terms of when, you know, not all states have it, but there are some jurisdictions in which you can get charged and convicted of murder in the first degree when you did not specifically intend to kill that person, but because you exhibited such recklessness or indifference to the life of the person you did kill, that we're gonna consider it about the same. And in this case, there is certainly a level of recklessness and indifference towards the lives of people who may have died in this episode that Itami is exhibiting, such that he's going to go to jail for a very long time, possibly ending up with life or a capital punishment. I'm just not sure that he's going to specifically get the train wrecking charge.
It's a tough one. I could still see him getting charged with it.
Oh, for sure. I just don't know if the prosecutor is going to be able to sufficiently prove the intent part of that.
Yeah, because it's, I made the monster, and then it just went about the countryside, and it dug lots of holes. Like, if he intentionally
fit... It did things that moles do, just 100 times larger.
Yeah, it's... It makes sense to go, well, he took out houses and he took out farmland, so like we can go after him for that because that's reasonably foreseeable. And like that could have been the intent, but did the intent include the train? But is he so reckless and deprived heart and deliberately indifferent to the human lives around that the jury's just going to say, screw it, hang him. And...
Also, felony murder? Sorry.
Felony murder rule right there. Yeah,
it's just another fun criminal legal doctrine. I actually really don't like felony murder, but it exists.
Yeah, it's, oh boy.
I actually want to cabin that one just because that could be a very long discussion. It's a topic of passion of mine. But there is another crime that I do want to discuss because it happens right at the beginning and there's a little bit of fun stuff to talk about with it, which is when Itami snuck himself into the greenhouse after hours, was he committing burglary? I just want to read off a couple definitions here. So the California definition of burglary is... every person who enters any house, room, apartment, tenement, shop, warehouse, store, mill, barn, stable, outhouse, or other building, tent, vessel, etc., including floating homes, railroad car, locked or sealed cargo container. This is a really long list.
Yeah.
Whether or not mounted on a vehicle, trailer coach, any house car, inhabited camper, or vehicle is defined by the vehicle code when the doors are locked, aircraft, any mine or underground portion thereof, end of list, with the intent to commit grand or petite larceny or any felony is guilty of burglary. So I want to compare this to the DC definition. So in DC, they define burglary as whoever shall, either in nighttime or in daytime, break and enter or enter without breaking any dwelling or room used as a sleeping apartment in any building. And I'm not going to go into the whole list this time, but dwelling with the intent to commit any criminal offense shall, if any person is in any part of such dwelling at the time of such breaking and entering, or entering without breaking, be guilty of burglary in the first degree, which is punishable by for not less than 5 years, no more than 30 years. There's also a subsection B, which defines burglary in the second degree, which is roughly the same. It has most of the same caveats, but it's any bank, store, warehouse, shop, or a dwelling which is not currently inhabited. Now, there's a couple fun things that I just want to note for people. The reason why, it seems kind of weird, right, Josh, that you would specify nighttime or in the daytime, because it seems like that would be any time. Why would you need to specify that? And also specifies break and enter or enter without breaking, right? Why not just say enter? The California one simply says enters. And that's because the common law definition of burglary used to be limited to breaking and entering. So you had to use some kind of force to enter the property. And it was limited to only in nighttime. So it seems a little weird. That's just how it was. I can't tell you exactly why that was the common law definition, but it was. So the DC law takes pretty great pains to indicate that it is overruling that common law definition. So it's either daytime or nighttime, and it specifies entering without breaking. And I say that specifically because I know that there is like a cultural wives' tale, I don't know, inaccurate impression that burglary requires that you use some kind of force, right? So like, oh, but the door was left open. If I just walk in, it's not burglary. And that kind of depends on your jurisdiction. So, you know, California just says entering. Maybe they still think there's the common law definition. But generally speaking, just entering without permission, just simple trespass is enough to fulfill that factor. The other part of it, though, is that with the intent to commit a crime. So if all you did was enter, then you have committed simple trespass. There's the important premise that you have to intend to commit a crime. Now, in California, it was larceny or a felony, and you see, it was any crime. So you could intend to spray paint the wall, which I assume is probably a misdemeanor. And in DC, that would be enough to get you to burglary. In California, that wouldn't. So those are just some fun things about burglary that I wanted to mention there. Now getting back to the episode, did a Tommy commit burglary when he entered the greenhouse? So it looks like he unlocked it, right? Would that qualify as breaking and entering, or can we at least, you know, is it, do we have to assume that the jurisdiction permits burglary just for entering?
It's definitely a trespass. So there's that.
Right, even if he's allowed to be there some of the time, he's clearly not supposed to be there at that time.
So, and the trespass would cover the unlocking the door to get in. So, burglary, it's like, did he take anything, or did he just go in? And if he just went in...
My understanding from having watched that scene is he seems to be in there for a relatively brief amount of time, right? With the grandpa, I assume he's like a groundskeeper or something. Hears the noise and goes and looks, and he's in the greenhouse for a short time. He's mostly dancing when he's doing it too. So my impression is that he did not bring the mole and feed the mole the honey. My impression is he may have stolen the honey, scooped the larva and the honey, and fed it to the mole somewhere else. In which case, that would be larceny, right? He is stealing something. I also think it's fair to assume, given the nature of this honey, that it is probably highly valuable. I think we're in felony territory.
If he took it, yes, because there aren't little mole tracks.
Yeah.
So there is no physical evidence that they discuss of the mole itself. There's right. only the broken glass, which is broken from the inside since the shards
with
are
on the hammer, by his hammer, yeah.
Yeah. So he was setting the mole up.
he framed the mole, yes. He
framed the mole and then experimented on the mole. So the mole had a lose-lose afternoon. Because if he went in, just damaged and, you know, destroyed the larva and everything else, and then broke the glass, that's trespassing and vandalism.
Right, so we'd be in burglary territory in DC, but not in California.
Exactly. So again, laws matter, words matter.
Yeah. Know the laws of wherever it is you live. They are important.
Yeah.
Especially if you intend to break into people's property. Don't break into people's property, people.
Don't do that. Yeah, don't do that. And this show has this weird message about, you know, at the beginning about...
the unbalanced time or something like that.
The unbalanced zone.
And, yeah.
And because, you know, the Itami is unbalanced. And then the line is, no, it exists within your very heart. It's like, well, that's messed up. You know, I'm not going to be like, say, jealous of someone and have a complex plan to create a giant mole. I mean, like, that's that's pretty extreme when you think about it. But it also, it's still not clear, did he plan for the mole? Did he? And, like, it's not...
Oh, I see.
Because it doesn't...
I see.
It doesn't, from what he says, it doesn't sound like he had actually planned for a mole. He just planned to smash things and make it look like an animal entered, not create a giant monster.
I see. So it's also possible, and I didn't interpret it this way, but I agree with you now that it is possible that he did not actually steal any honey when he was in there or bring a mole in to feed it, was simply trying to make it look as though something had broken in. But having left a hole in the glass, a mole did later get in later that night after he departed.
But didn't leave any tracks. Like, that's the weird thing. And nor could the mole tunnel inside, because so the mole would have to surface, go through, and then somehow not leave any tracks.
Right.
Okay, so it gets very...
Which is why I'm going with the theory that he stole the honey and did intend to feed it to an animal to try to frame Kimura for some disaster. But...
Yeah, it's possible. We don't get a clean answer. So again,
I did look it up because I was curious what was going on with the narration about the unbalanced zone. And at least according to the fan page for this show, the unbalanced zone was originally going to be a theme for the series. And they eventually decided not to make it the overriding theme, but it still is in there in a lot of these episodes. So it was no longer the overarching narrative, but it's still in there. I agree with you, though, that I'm going to charitably interpret this as a cautionary tale, that there is deep emotional volatility within each of us. I mean, this is a theme in Star Trek with, you know, the Vulcans. There is deep emotional instability within all of us. Every human has the potential for a violent impulse or an immoral impulse, but not that we're all doomed to do what Itami did. Most of us will not, because we know that we have these impulses and we know how to control them. And so when we lie awake at night, racked with jealousy for our rival, our hated rival, we know how to deal with that in a healthy way and to resist the impulse to destroy entire towns to get to him.
I would hope so. I certainly would hope so. That's a high bar.
It's an optimistic note also to have this podcast go to.
I sincerely hope that's the case. We also have, let's just talk about the ending. So they, after Itami is like confronted with the Scooby-Doo moment and he yells liar and runs away, the army's called in because the army would show up at this. And it's great. One of the subtitles does say Giant Mole Command Center, and that's just adorable.
Yes.
God bless him. And we have like the gang run into the tunnel to go confront the mole. I mean, I'm not sure that's the smartest.
I know. I wasn't sure what the plan was there.
Go grab her, Ray. I don't think so. And we have a Tommy who, you know, basically says, I'm going to clean up my mess. And he tries to blow up the mole himself.
With dynamite, right? Some kind of explosive.
Yeah, and it's the old style, like, you know, you push down on the plunger. So it's not like he's doing the suicide run of come at me mole with like dynamite strapped to him. I mean, that would be wild, but that's not what happened. So he tries to blow up the mole, and then he staggers out of the tunnel all, you know, disheveled. And, you know, we have him admit, I love her too. But he doesn't die. He passes out because there are three guys that carry him away, because you wouldn't just leave the limp body. It's like, you know what? This is super dangerous, but we're going to carry the corpse with us.
Yeah. You know, maybe they just take their treatment of the dead that seriously. I seriously doubt it.
Nope. The giant mole's coming. We're going to run like hell. And the army does open up on the mole. So there's tanks, and the mole didn't ask.
They're missile launchers. Those were giant batteries of missiles.
Yeah, they look like mid-range, you know, like tactical yes. nukes, you know, but conventional. But like the type of thing you would expect in, you know, West Germany,
yes.
the Soviet Union, you know, like that sort of short range, you know, missile.
This is very on brand for Toho, in my opinion, though. There is any excuse you have to roll out the hardware, you do it.
And the models are awesome. Like the little
tanks, yeah.
You can see the guys in them and the missiles launching. But like the missiles launching at such close range, it's like they're not targeting the mole, because that'd be like hitting the mole with a spear. It should kill Mr. Mole. But like they're blowing up the mountain and like burying him. And then the mole is like, since he's getting his butt kicked, and again, he doesn't ask for this. He's just a mole. You know, he starts digging down.
He's doing mole things. All he did this whole episode was dig.
Apparently, you know, he hits this like lava vein so like we have this volcanic eruption and lava coming up out of the ground, and the little village collapses into like, you know, it's like City of Atlantis sinking into the sea type disaster level. And, you know, everyone watching this, like, starts, like, laughing and applauding, and the photographer girl starts taking pictures, and everyone's laughing and smiling. It's like, you took out a town. The mole.
If I remember correctly, the last scene is eerily quiet, except for the shutter snaps of that journalist lady who's still taking pictures. Like, what are we watching?
as this lava, you know, consumes the mole. That had to be a horrible way to go. And
yeah.
It had to smell bad too, because
all
that fur and the lava.
Oh no!
It's bad on so many levels, and so it raises issues of like the town gets wiped out. Who is that? Just an oopsie? You know, is that the army's fault or are they just? They're already thinking, like, we're already at FEMA level response anyway, so let's just go big. I mean...
Well, especially because it was asked specifically whether or not there were lava veins under that town. It was asked like a few scenes earlier, aren't there active lava veins going to Mount Fuji or something like that? And they knew, I think they knew that this was a possibility.
Yeah, and it's like, they're like, yay, it worked! It's like, dude.
I'm going to speculate that there was a similar level of military planning that went into that operation as during the Shoot the Invader.
Oh, absolutely.
I have this idea for using many missiles, and it will definitely destroy the monster, but it will also destroy the town. No, we should think of another alternative. No, no time for complacency.
Yeah, the mindset of, in order to save the town, we have to destroy the town, and... You know, because that did wonders for us in Vietnam. And yeah, don't do that.
I'm going to assume they evacuated the village, but maybe I'm being rosy and optimistic. No, Josh is not, just does not think that was the case.
They got out, okay.
Yeah, this is the conversation you will be having if you watch this with your children.
He went to a farm upstate. Sadly, no. It's delightful. There are a lot of other fun episodes, and I haven't watched all of the Blu-ray set yet, so I know there are more to see. But we've been bouncing between Ultraman, the animated, and Ultra Q. And my good friend said that Plato TV also has a lot of the other Sentai shows. Yeah, so, which is like Ultra 7, Kamen Rider, and all kinds of other stuff that we could get into. And this also highlights what happened at Denver Pop Culture Con when we did our Godzilla panel. We were asked about Torisatsu, whether, you know, like, you know, we got into Ultraman, and the answer was like, no, not yet. Well, now we have.
Now we will. So, yeah.
Right there, dude. So, hope you're listening. Hope you are listening. But yes, that would be, it'd be fun. to ask the, you know, the AG from Colorado how he would prosecute this, what he would
definitely
do.
I don't have any like Toho or anything. I do have this guy, by the way. This is from Monster Hunter.
That is so adorable. This
qualifies as a kaiju. I do have a toy kaiju.
I do have a Kong. I do have a plush Godzilla, and I do have the Gravedons on the way. So can't wait for those to arrive. yeah, but I can see getting a few more plush toys as well, because again, they're fun for blog posts. And
so far among the episodes we've covered, a fair number of these kaiju have been adorable. I also think the mole is cute. I feel so bad for it.
It was just like that was part of the reason I wanted to do this. Like, that's a great costume. I mean, like, yeah. they still deal with it. It's, you know, like they limit the shots of the hind legs because at the end of the day it's still like a dude.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, it's like that's a problem with some of the four-legged kaiju. Mm-hmm. And except for Gravedon, they actually did, I think, because of part of how they shaped that costume.
Yeah, yeah.
That it looked okay. Mm-hmm. You know, make it look like a Stegosaurus, you know, type.
Yeah, and I think it helps that Gravedon doesn't really use his back legs very much, so he's mostly in favor of lying there. So
that was a wise call. But again, there are more of these that we can cover, and we will, because hey, it's how we're spending the month of April. And yes.
Yes, thank you all for joining us during our quarantine. This is making it much better.
Well, we should probably, I'm trying to say shelter in place, because quarantine implies a different level.
Oh, yeah. Quarantine is there has been a, we think there has been a risk of exposure. Yeah. As far as I know, I have not been exposed because I've been doing my due diligence, almost no trips to the grocery store, nothing else. So yeah, self-isolation. Thank you for joining us during our self-isolation.
Shopping online, and yeah, if you go to the grocery store, go at a low peak time and maintain social distancing. Yes.
Oh, and look through your cabinets to see those, like, for example, I looked through recently and found some packets of pasta that I forgot existed. So you'd be surprised, but you've got squirreled away in those hard to reach corners. It can help you make it another few days before you have to go to the store.
Yes, indeed. Very important to have grocery shopping lists, and yeah, crazy times. Crazy.
Again, these will be the stories you tell your grandkids about how you dealt with the COVID crisis.
Yes, we were warned during the confetti, but we didn't pay attention. We didn't know what would happen. Oh, yes. But anyway, thank you all. So if you enjoy us, leave a review. If you have an idea, send us a note that, you know, if you think that there's an issue episode of Kamen Rider that we would enjoy, or any of the other ultras that we should check out, let us know, or other anime, because there could be like Bubblegum Crisis, or we could do Akira. There's a lot there.
Oh my god, yes. I happen to love Akira.
okay, that's on the books. I have most of the series, and do have the Blu-ray. So yeah, there's a lot of good stuff as we explore, and other monsters as well. So I want to get into some Harryhausen and some others. So everyone, check out our Patreon. We do have some extra content there. Stay home, stay safe, and we'll see you all very soon.